Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. This is episode number 173. Today we have a special Greatest Hits episode number 5, which is a carefully curated combination of timely and timeless stories from late 2020 into 2022. So here we go. This from The Nation's Health. Study: rate of unplanned pregnancies still too high. Almost half of all pregnancies that occurred globally in recent years were unintended, according to a new study. The research published in The Lancet Global Health estimated unintended pregnancy and abortion rates by income level, region, and other measures. The study was led by the Guttmacher Institute, a research organization advancing women's health, and the UN Human Reproduction Program. Each year during the 2015 to 2019 study period, there were about 121 million unintended pregnancies, defined as a pregnancy a woman did not mean to have. Over 70 million of these pregnancies ended in abortion. These findings show a clear need for prioritizing a comprehensive approach to essential sexual and reproductive health and rights, including access to safe and legal abortion, which is critical to women's health, particularly during the pandemic and ensuing economic recession, Hermione Palacio, MD-MPH, President and CEO of the Guttmacher Institute, said during a telebriefing. Researchers analyzed data from 166 countries between 1990 and 2019 on pregnancy intentions and abortions. Their findings revealed staggering inequities between women in high-income countries and those in low-income countries. Women in the poorest countries were nearly three times more likely to experience unintended pregnancies than women in the wealthiest countries. But unplanned pregnancies are experienced by women from all socioeconomic groups, said Jonathan Barak, PhD, senior research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute and lead author of the study. Unintended pregnancy and abortion are reproductive health experiences shared by tens of millions of people around the world, irrespective of personal status or circumstances. What differs are the obstacles people face. For example, legal, social, and economic obstacles in exercising their reproductive autonomy. A major obstacle for women with unplanned and unwanted pregnancies is access to safe abortion. Around the world, two dozen countries do not allow any abortions, while about 40 allow them only when a woman's life is at risk. The tragic paradox is that currently abortion services are most needed where they are least legally available, Zareed Ahmad, Associate Director of Federal Issues at the Guttmacher Institute, said during the telebriefing. And because abortion is essential health care, people still find ways to get one, even if it means resorting to unsafe methods. While unintended pregnancies have declined overall during the past three decades, the abortion rate has returned to levels seen in the 1990s, the study said. Abortion increased by 12% in countries with highly restricted access, but decreased slightly in regions where it is legal. Legal restrictions don't stop abortion from happening. They physically, emotionally, and financially punish people seeking abortion care, and they disproportionately harm people with the fewest resources. Ahmed called for investments in sexual and reproductive health to improve the safety and health of women. Abortion is part of a basic human right to control one's reproductive destiny. So we think the countries and partners around the world should be investing in sexual and reproductive health and the full package, including access to safe abortion. And if they want to ensure that people can control their reproductive autonomy and make the decisions that are best for them and their families. To this from DW.com, how drugs damage the environment. Whether they smoked a joint on the couch or sniffed a line in a club, some 269 million people around the world indulged in drugs in 2018, according to the United Nations. Cocaine production is at record levels. Opium has been on an upward trend for the past decade. The market for synthetic drugs is growing in the Netherlands, and some countries are legalizing cannabis. In short, business is booming. It is no secret that drug trafficking and cartel wars cost human lives, but so far there has been little focus on how this global trade impacts the environment. Cultivating thirsty marijuana plantations is a serious problem in California, which is plagued by forest fires and drought. With 192 million users in 2018, cannabis is by far the most popular drug worldwide, excluding, of course, alcohol and tobacco. Efforts to legalize marijuana are continuing to gather pace in the United States, where the drug has already become a billion-dollar market. But cultivating the plants in greenhouses with optimum light, ventilation, and temperature guzzles an enormous amount of resources. According to estimates, cannabis production in the U.S. already accounts for around 1% of the country's total energy consumption. Within a single year, approximately 15 million metric tons of carbon dioxide are emitted in the United States as a result of indoor cannabis production, equivalent to the annual emission of 3 million cars, according to the report by the University of California, Davis. That means that a single joint has a similar carbon footprint to about 6.6 pounds of potatoes. Most of the marijuana in the booming U.S. cannabis industry is grown in energy-hungry greenhouses. Cannabis is also an extremely thirsty plant, needing twice as much water as tomatoes or grapes. About 70% of the cannabis consumed across the country is grown in California. Such large-scale cultivation of a crop that requires up to 22 liters, 6 gallons of water per day per plant has only intensified the region's water shortages during dry seasons. Scientists from the California Department of Fisheries and Wildlife estimate that illegal outdoor cultivation has lowered the water level in some flowing streams by up to a quarter. Clearing forests to plant coca. The ecological footprint of the world's 19 million cocaine users is particularly apparent in Latin America. According to the United Nations, Colombia has the potential to produce 1,120 tons of pure cocaine in 2018, a record crop for the South American country. Since 2001, more than 741 million acres of forests have been cleared for the cultivation of coca, the plant that produces cocaine. Following a temporary decline, we actually see the same peak of coca that we were watching 20 years ago, Paulo Sandoval, a geographer at the University of Oregon, said. Colombia's approach, quote, harms the environment. Until now, the Colombian government has relied on a strategy of eradication in its fight against coca cultivation. As part of its campaign, aircraft sprayed plantations with a highly concentrated herbicide glyphosate. This method effectively destroyed many coca plantations, but it also damaged neighboring forests and farmland. Elizabeth Tellman, a geographer at Columbia University's Earth Institute in New York, says this approach harms rather than helps the environment. And once the fields are destroyed, the cartel simply clears more forests elsewhere and plant new coca crops. Coca leaves aren't just grown in the jungle. They're also processed into cocaine in secret laboratories there. This process requires highly toxic chemicals such as ammonia, acetone, and hydrochloric acid. Scientists estimate that several million liters of these substances end up in soils and rivers each year. There are now few aquatic plants or animals living in these contaminated waters, according to a 2015 EU report. Scientists in the Netherlands say the toxic waste produced by the manufacture of illegal drugs pollutes the country's rivers. MDMA, ecstasy, and company. So-called party drugs, from pills to a line of powder in a nightclub bathroom, have grown in popularity in recent years. The Netherlands and Belgium are hotspots for synthetic drugs. The production of a kilo of pure MDMA, the main substance in ecstasy, results in 10 kilos of toxic waste, or 30 kilos in the case of amphetamines. This might include sodium hydroxide, hydrochloric acids, and acetone, substance that would normally have to be disposed of as hazardous waste using protective suits. The Dutch Water Research Institute, KWR, estimates that in 2017, around 7,000 tons of these substances were either dumped somewhere in drums or leaked into the ground and rivers. That's unbelievable, says Eric Emke, a scientist at the KWR. Emke says the waste is sometimes dumped into containers used to collect cattle excrement, becoming mixed with the dung that is spread onto corn crops. And so, 5 years ago, they discovered amphetamine and ecstasy residues in corn lice. Jeremy Douglas, the regional representative at the UN's Office on Drugs and Crime in Southeast Asia, says Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar have also become a hub for industrial-scale global synthetic drug production in recent years. The spillover damage to groundwater and habitats is severe, and frankly, it is nothing short of an ecological and public health disaster, he said. Groundwater sinking in Afghanistan. Around 337,000 football fields, or 23 times the size of Paris. That's the amount of land that was used to cultivate opium worldwide in 2019, according to the United Nations. The main producers are Myanmar, Mexico, and Afghanistan, which accounts for 84% of global cultivation. Poppy fields spread mainly across the country's southwest in areas where, until the 1990s, there was nothing but arid desert. Today, some 1.4 million people live there, making a living from cultivating opium and agriculture. That's all possible thanks to more than 50,000 solar-powered water pumps that have greened the desert. But it is not as green as it sounds. Opium cultivation supports some 1.4 million people in southern Afghanistan, but is also robbing the region of its water. A report by socioeconomist David Mansfield found that the region's groundwater is sinking by about 10 feet per year. Wells as deep as 130 meters, or about 300 feet, are now being drilled to find water. Each year, 400 feet. Okay, I got to work on my metrics. Each year, more people are arriving in the desert installing solar deep wells. There are local fears, and there will fast become a time when agriculture production is no longer viable. The poppy farmers also use chemical fertilizer and strong pesticides to control weeds. Groundwater tests have shown that nitrate levels are significantly higher than what is deemed safe. This can increase the risk of blue baby syndrome, which leads to heart defects and death in newborns. Mansfield warns that if water in the region does eventually run out, it will force large numbers of people from their homes, sparking a rural exodus. This from The Hill. Science supports new dietary guidelines limiting alcohol consumption. Probably not a good way to deal with stress, though, anyways. But okay, here we go. Recently, an advisory committee of 20 nationally recognized scientific experts recommended changing federal dietary guidelines on alcohol consumption, with limits for men who drink lowered from 2 drinks per day to 1 drink per day. The recommendations are driven by solid evidence. Even moderate alcohol consumption is associated with significant health risks. The experts' report explains why. These experts are not ideologues. Indeed, they were all appointed by the Trump administration. Nevertheless, the alcohol industry and its allies have attempted to caricature the committee members as, quote, nanny state bureaucrats. In the help of lobbying budget in excess of $27 million, Big Alcohol has enlisted the support of congressional representatives in second-guessing the committee's recommendations. Federal officials should stand their ground and incorporate the experts' recommendations into the dietary guidelines for Americans. The preponderance of scientific and medical knowledge, the legally prescribed basis for the dietary guidelines, made crystal clear that the recommendations reflect the best science available today. U.S. researchers now estimate that drinking alcohol is the third most significant cause of cancer that is within a person's control, behind smoking and obesity. Each year, alcohol consumption causes more cancer deaths than exposure to ultraviolet radiation. In fact, drinking alcohol increases the risk of at least 6 cancer types. The cancer risk increases with heavier levels of consumption, but an established and growing body of research shows that even light alcohol consumption, less than 1 drink per day, also causes cancer, with the incidence of cancer of the breast, oral cavity, pharynx, and esophagus, among others, increasing significantly among light drinkers. With the exception of breast cancer, the types of cancer known to be caused by drinking alcohol, stomach, esophageal, head and neck, colorectal, and liver, are much more common in men, pointing to a need for men in particular to cut back. By contrast, earlier claims that moderate drinking confers health benefits, including improved cardiovascular health, have not aged well. The availability of large prospective cohort studies and the advent of whole genome sequencing technology have allowed researchers to bypass some of the confounding factors that plagued earlier studies, and the results of this genetic epidemiology have cast further doubt on the purported protective effects of moderate drinking. All this is to say the evidence in support of moderate alcohol consumption improving cardiovascular health is highly suspect, whereas the scientific evidence linking alcohol consumption to cancer is well established and growing. Respected cancer organizations, including the American Institute for Cancer Research and the American Cancer Society, advise not drinking alcohol to reduce cancer risk. The federal dietary guidelines should also advise consumers that drinking alcohol does not improve health, and if consumers do drink, urge them to drink as little as possible. Will the modest change proposed for the dietary guidelines have a significant impact? Millions of men in the U.S. now regularly drink in excess of the two-drink limit, first prescribed in the 1990 guidelines. But the guidelines do matter. They're required by law to be promoted by all federal government food and nutrition programs and policies, and they are often used by private and nonprofit organizations, too. For decades, alcohol has been depicted as part of a healthy diet, with any ill effects limited to binge drinkers and alcoholics. This portrayal has succeeded so well that most consumers in the United States remain unaware of the link between alcohol use and cancer. The American Institute for Cancer Research recent survey showed that less than half of U.S. consumers identify alcohol as a cancer risk factor. For the sake of our collective health, that needs to change. The dietary guidelines can help, so long as they are driven by science and not corporate influence. This from Civil Eats. Can local food feed big cities? Yes, if we cut down on meat. New research shows that shifting to lower meat diets would allow cities to source more or all of their food locally. This has been a banner year for local food. As the pandemic disrupted large-scale food processing and national and international supply chains, many consumers turned to local food options, like community-supported agriculture programs, local meat processors, and urban farms. While the supply chain has since stabilized, many local food advocates are hoping that this new emphasis can help make the food system more resilient in the face of other challenges, like the climate crisis. Now, a new study from Tufts University provides the most comprehensive answers yet to an underlying fundamental question. With the majority of people concentrated in cities, how possible it is to localize food production in the U.S.? It depends, based on the type of food produced on surrounding land, based on where you live, and based on the type of diet, said Julie Kurtz, who spearheaded the research as a master's student alongside lead author Christian Peters at Tufts School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Using data on the populations of major metropolitan areas, estimated productivity of surrounding farmland, and food needs across seven different diets, researchers found that many cities, especially those in the middle of the country in the Northwest, could feed their entire population with food produced within 155 miles. On the other hand, many coastal cities would need to source food from much further distances to feed their large populations. And while generalizations are difficult, there is one big takeaway. In all regions, shifting to lower meat diets increased the potential to localize food production. That's where our model shows the most immediate opportunity, Kurt said. When you move to a 20% omnivorous diet, that's where pretty much the entire country can go local, with the exception of part of Florida and part of California. Of course, local food systems face many barriers beyond the mere existence of adequate farmland, including how to finance expensive infrastructure and compete with international corporations that produce vast amounts of cheap food. And while there are many ongoing debates on the benefits of localizing, experts say this kind of research is important to having a more informed conversation about the potential. One barrier in realizing the full potential of local food systems, said Ricardo Salvador, director of the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, is that many people have a hard time imagining a world in which strawberries and pineapple are not available in Vermont in January. It then creates this expectation that unless we have that globalized industrial food system, we can't feed ourselves, that there really is no other meaningful alternative, Salvador said. The majority of us are so blinded by the fact that we won't even be open-minded about how much more we could do in terms of local and regional production. This study, he said, provides data to back up what is possible. The need for grazing land to satisfy the demand for beef is one reason people in many regions would have to source food from farther away, and why diets that include less of both can reduce the distance. Even cattle that spend the last part of their lives in concentrated animal feeding operations spend most of their lives out on pasture. Columbus, Ohio, for example, has enough cropland within about 200 miles to feed its population, but the range would need to extend out about 700 miles to include enough grazing land. If everyone in the city switched to a diet that included meat and other animal products at just 20% of meals, there would be enough grazing land within just 20 miles. Switching to vegetarian diets that eliminate meat but include milk and eggs would decrease the amount of land needed to localize production at a similar rate. However, switching to vegan diets does not further shrink the radius needed to grow local food. The Union of Concerned Scientists Salvador added, there are any number of farm families and rural economies that could be strengthened and thrive if they were the source of the supply for the major metropolitan areas in this study. and he sees those thriving food economies all over the country as potential insurance against disruptions caused by crises like COVID-19. One of the multiple lessons of the pandemic is that we become so dependent on the linearized industrial food system, so that if one part of supply chain is disrupted, it has huge ripple effects throughout the entire food system, he said. Rather than take that as a one-off rare vulnerability, we should actually learn that we need a more resilient, much more distributed food system. Okay, well, there's a story with a lot of hope, but let's look at what we're up against. This from the Food Politics blog. Concentration in the food business. Too high, too risky. A report to the Family Farm Action Alliance. The food system, concentration and its impact, shows just how monopolistic this industry has become. The CR4 metric is the percentage of a particular industry owned by the top four companies. The top four beef processing companies control 73% of all beef processing. The top four soft drink companies control 82%. The top three cereal companies control 80%. Anything over 50% is considered to be highly concentrated. So what's wrong with those in the high CR4 index? Agri-food consolidation reduces farmer autonomy and redistributes costs and benefits across the food chain, squeezing farmer incomes. In 2018, farmers whose primary occupation was farming, but with sales of less than $350,000, had a median net income of minus $1,524. An agriculture system without people has depopulated rural communities, causing a collapse in social relationships. Communities of color bear a disproportionate burden of exposure to excessive pesticide use or large animal confinement operations. What is to be done? At the heart of this analysis is a focus on power, both economic and political. Ultimately, American political democracy rests on economic democracy and vice versa. Thus, our laser focus in scholarship, praxis, and policy must be on democratizing the agri-food system through a multitude of strategies at local, state, regional, and national scales. And this is from nutritionfacts.org. Hospitals profit on junk food. Why is hospital food so unhealthy? Put in stark terms, cardiovascular disease claims one American life every 39 seconds. And for most heart attack deaths, you just keel over. Sudden cardiac death is the first manifestation of coronary heart disease for the majority of individuals, particularly among women. So for many of these sudden death victims, their first indication of the presence of heart disease was their demise. They don't even know that they had heart disease. That's why an ounce of prevention is worth way more than a pound of cure, because there's no cure for dead. That's why the prevention of sudden cardiac death remains such a major public health challenge, because most people don't even know they're at risk. But we've known for over half a century, when we first started studying autopsying young servicemen who died in the Korean War, that coronary artery disease begins in our youth, even among young children. So business as usual is simply not going to yield the improvements necessary to radically improve the cardiovascular health of the United States. But the good news is a low-risk lifestyle, not smoking, exercising regularly, having a prudent diet, and maintaining a healthy weight, may be able to wipe out the vast majority of risk for sudden cardiac death. So the time is now long overdue to start aggressive preventive cardiovascular disease programs in our schools, our homes, and our work sites. How about starting in our hospitals? A significant percentage of hospitals surveyed had fast food restaurants inside them, with Krispy Kreme topping the list. Brilliant marketing, given that families surveyed in hospitals with McDonald's were twice as likely to think McDonald's was healthy. After all, they let it in a hospital. But what about food served in hospital cafeterias themselves? Are they much better? 384 entrees were analyzed at 14 children's hospitals in California, and only 7% could be classified as healthy. And just in case someone accidentally picked the rare healthy option, 81% of eating venues in children's hospitals made sure to have junky impulse buys like ice cream, cookies, and candy near the checkout register. And 38% had signs that explicitly encouraged unhealthy eating. Why would they do that? If you ask hospital cafeteria managers that exact question, why they don't tend to follow nutrition standards, why nutrition is not a top priority, it's the same answer why unhealthy food is sold anywhere else: the pressure to generate profit. Increased emphasis is being placed on running a hospital food service department as a profit center, a bigger and bigger profit center. It's such a metaphor for a sickness care system in general, where healthy treat the cause approaches are eclipsed by the pills and procedures that bring in the most money. Well, what do you expect from the private sector? But public hospitals don't see much better. A 2019 analysis of veterans hospitals found that all VA hospitals contain vending machines providing a majority of soda, candy, and junk foods that directly conflict with the, quote, our government's own healthy food choice recommendations, such that, ironically, hospital visits could theoretically promote worse health. This raises the question why any soda or candy machines are available at our VA hospitals. Are we trading the health of our veterans for profits? Maybe it's time to ban junk food on hospital premises. On daily rounds, it is appalling to see patients gorging on potato chips, candy, and soda, the very foods that have been contributed to their admission in the first place. Obscene to see fast food franchises on site legitimizing the acceptability and consumption of such foods in the daily diet. The obesity epidemic represents a public health crisis, but it is a public health scandal that by legitimizing junk food, hospitals have themselves become a risk factor for diet-related disease. Maybe it's time to stop selling sickness in the hospital. What message do residents receive when they are fed pizza and soda pop at grand rounds on obesity? We need a healthcare system with more Hippocrates and less hypocrisy. This from Science Daily, how hope can make you happier with your lot in life. Having hope for the future could protect people from risky behaviors such as drinking and gambling, according to a new research from the University of East Anglia. Researchers studied relative deprivation, the feeling that other people have things better than you in life. They wanted to find out why only some people experiencing this turn to escapist and risky behaviors such as drinking, alcohol, taking drugs, overeating, or gambling, while others do not. And they found that the answer lies in hope. Postgraduate researcher Shahryar Kasharvars from their school of psychology said, I think most people have experienced relative deprivation at some point in their life. It's that feeling of being unhappy with your lot, the belief that your situation is worse than others, that other people are doing better than you. Roosevelt famously said that comparison is the thief of joy. It's that feeling you have when a friend buys a new car, or your sister gets married, or a colleague finds a better job, or has a better income. Relative deprivation can trigger negative emotions like anger and resentment, and has been associated with poor coping strategies like risk-taking, drinking, taking drugs, or gambling. But not everyone scoring high on measures of relative deprivation makes these poor life choices. We wanted to find out why some people seem to cope better or even use the experience to their advantage to improve their own situation. There's a lot of evidence to show that remaining hopeful in the face of adversity can be advantageous. So we wanted to see if hope can help people feel happier with their lot and buffer against risky behaviors. We looked at the people who scored high for relative deprivation, the ones that thought their situation in life was worse than those around them, and we looked at those who also scored high for hope. We found that the volunteers who scored high for hope were much less likely to take risks in the game. Those who weren't too hopeful were a lot more likely to take risks. The research team says that nurturing hope in people who are unhappy with their lot could protect against harmful behaviors like drinking and gambling. From Mad in America, getting at how medicines are not necessarily the best way to deal with mental health as well, is suicide rates did not decrease when antidepressant drugs were introduced. If antidepressant drugs worked to reduce suicide, we would see a decrease in suicide rates when antidepressants began to be widely adopted. This would be true around 1960 when the first generation drugs emerged, and even more pronounced around 1990 when the SSRIs exploded in popularity. To test this, researchers looked at suicide rates in three countries, Italy, Austria, and Switzerland, over time. They found that there was no association between these time periods and suicide rates. The drugs did not appreciably change suicide rates at all. The association between antidepressant drugs and suicidality is controversial. Numerous studies have found that antidepressant drugs actually increase the suicidality, especially in children and young adults. However, rarely some studies have found unclear results, indicating that antidepressants may not have an appreciable effect on suicidality either way in adults on average. Thus, increased prescription of the drugs is statistically associated with decreased suicide, but the trend had already started before the drugs were being used, so they could not be the cause of the decreased suicide rate. So we kind of make a presumption oftentimes in medicine that the medicines actually work. But we know that basically half or more of the medical interventions that physicians and healthcare workers use actually are not proven efficacious. And here's a very interesting study that gets at mental health from a more broader perspective, you could say a public health perspective. versus kind of a medical treatment approach. This also from Mad in America. Giving people money is more effective for mental health than brief therapy. A new study found that direct payments improved psychological well-being for those in poverty, while 5 weeks of therapy did not. A study with 5,756 participants from rural Kenya found that money, not therapy, was needed to improve psychological well-being. The researchers report, "Our main finding is that after 1 year, cash transfers have larger effects on economic and psychological well-being than the mental health intervention, which itself produces no improvements relative to control." The researchers compared four groups: people given cash transfers, people given 5 weeks of therapy, people given both cash transfers and therapy, and people given none of the interventions, the control group. The cash transfers consisted of $485 U.S. dollars, which has the purchasing power in rural Kenya of about 1,076 U.S. dollars. The researchers note that the per household cost of cash payments was less than the per household cost of the 5 weeks of therapy. According to the researchers, after 1 year, therapy had made no difference compared to the control group, but the cash transfer had increased psychological well-being and increased economic outcomes. The group that received both therapy and money had similar outcomes to the group that received only money, suggesting that therapy did not add anything useful. 1 year after the interventions, cash transfer recipients had higher consumption, asset holdings, and revenue, as well as higher levels of psychological well-being than control households. In contrast, the psychotherapy program had no measurable effects on either psychological or economic outcomes, both for individuals with poor mental health at baseline or others. One limitation of the study was that 5 weeks of therapy is a short duration and might not be long enough for positive effects to arise. However, the type of therapy used was Problem Management Plus, recommended by the World Health Organization as the flagship psychotherapy for low-income settings. Trained community health workers delivered it. Thus, the researchers did pick the most highly recommended and supposedly effective therapy for this situation. It is also possible that any effects of psychotherapy had dissipated by the 1 year follow-up time period. Perhaps psychotherapy had a positive effect, but it simply does not last as long. However, this still provides a powerful contrast, since the less expensive intervention of direct cash payments did provide positive outcomes that lasted until the 1 year follow-up. The study was also limited on its focus on people in rural Kenya, all living in poverty. It is unclear if the same effects would be found in high socioeconomic status populations or a Western population. However, the study's findings are consistent with previous research. A study in Lancet Psychiatry found that rising unemployment rates are linked to increased suicide rates. Another study found the same result for economic deprivation more generally. Yet another study found that each successive step of increasing exploitation of workers, such as overwork and wage theft, tripled the risk of psychiatric diagnosis. This is not even the first study of trying to give people money to improve outcomes. A 2015 study found that giving people in poverty about $73 per month was associated with improved outcomes. And as for whether psychotherapy is effective for people in poverty, a recent study found that people living in poverty had poor outcomes from psychotherapy, which supports the current finding that therapy was insufficient for improving people's well-being. The implication is that talking with a psychotherapist can do little when people are deprived of the basic necessities of life. Money is a far more powerful tool in improving life. So there you go, people. Instead of paying for professional services for low-income, impoverished people, maybe just give them the money that those services would cost, and they may very well be better off. Somehow this seems kind of intuitive to me, but it's nice to see a research study that confirms it. This from Science Daily. People in societies where money plays a minimal role can have very high levels of happiness. Economic growth is often prescribed as a sure way of increasing the well-being of people in low-income countries. But a study led by McGill and the Institute of Environmental Sciences and Technologies at the University Autónoma de Barcelona suggests that there may be good reason to question this assumption. The researchers set out to find out how people rate their subjective well-being in societies where money plays a minimal role, which are not usually included in global happiness surveys. They found that the majority of people reported remarkably high levels of happiness. This was especially true in the communities with the lowest levels of monetization, where citizens reported a degree of happiness comparable to that found in Scandinavian countries, which typically have the highest rates in the world. The results suggest that high levels of subjective well-being can be achieved with minimal monetization, challenging the perception that economic growth will automatically raise life satisfaction among low-income populations. In less monetized sites, we found that people reported a greater proportion of time spent with family and contact with nature as being responsible for making them happy, explained Sarah Mignaro, the lead author on the study. This from CNN. Atlanta creates the nation's largest free food forest with hopes of addressing food insecurity. When a dormant pecan farm in the neighborhoods of South Atlanta closed, the land was soon rezoned and earmarked to become townhouses. But when the townhouses never came to fruition, and with the lot remaining in foreclosure, the Conservation Fund bought it in 2016 to develop an unexpected project, the nation's largest free food forest. Thanks to a U.S. Forest Service grant and a partnership between the City of Atlanta, the Conservation Fund, and Trees Atlanta, you'll find 7.1 acres of land ripe with 2,500 pesticide-free edible and medicinal plants only 10 minutes from Atlanta's airport, the world's busiest airport before the pandemic struck. The forest is in the Browns Mill neighborhood of southeast Atlanta, where the closest grocery store is a 30-minute bus ride away. Access to green space and healthy foods is very important, and that's a part of our mission, says Michael McCord, a certified arborist and expert edible landscaper who helps manage the forest. The forest is part of the City of Atlanta's larger mission to bring healthy food within half a mile of 85% of Atlanta's 500,000 residents by 2022. Though as recently as 2014, it was illegal to grow food on residential lots in the city. Resources like the food forest are a rarity and a necessity in Atlanta as 1 in 6 Georgians face food insecurity. 1 in 3 Browns Mill residents live below the poverty line, and 1 in 4 Atlantans live in food deserts so severe, some find it more apt to call the problem supermarket redlining. We host lots of students for field trips, and for a lot of them, it's their first time to a garden or farm or forest, said McCord. So here they get to experience everything urban agriculture and urban forestry all in one day. It's really special. The forest is now owned by the Parks Department, and more than 1,000 volunteers and neighbors are helping to plant, water, and maintain the forest. In a day alone, there can be more than 50 volunteers working on the forest. That work of maintaining the forest is done by volunteers as a testament to the forest's ability to build community, said Carla Smith, an Atlanta City Councilwoman who helped start the project. It's really a park for everyone, said Smith. Every time I go there, there's a community there who respects and appreciates the fresh, healthy foods. There's a mentality that people know only to take what they need. Though there have been a few problems with people taking more than they need, the forest managers ask that community members are given priority when food is harvested. Additionally, food not grown in plots is harvested by the forest volunteers, not visitors, and then distributed. Initiatives to make urban cities more edible are catching on. There are at least 70 free food forests in the country. And in free food forests in Seattle, Portland, and Asheville, thousands of pounds of food are harvested each year. For McCord, that's a sign that urban agriculture is moving in the right direction. Everything out of a park space is a teachable moment, whether it be trees, trails, bees, or vegetables. That's what's most important to me, that we're raising awareness about sustainability and agriculture. Okay, folks, well, if you're out there battling with depression and you can't really wait for social justice to solve all our problems, here's an article from the National Association on Mental Illness, one of their blogs, that may be helpful. What to do when your friends and family are unsupportive of your depression. When you're going through depression, it can be even more difficult to cope when your friends and family are unsupportive. It can even worsen symptoms when someone you're close to makes cold or thoughtless comments or blames you for your symptoms. So, what do you do in this situation? Well, the ideal is to surround yourself with people who are understanding of what you're going through or trying through or willing to try and understand. This is not always possible. Here are some things you can do for yourself when those closest to you don't understand. Acknowledge the situation. At a certain point, you must realize and acknowledge that not everyone will understand. There could be a certain reason they're behaving that way that has nothing to do with you. It's possible this is an ingrained and subconscious behavior if they grew up learning that. It's unacceptable to show any signs of mental health issues, or that symptoms of mental illness are signs of, quote, weakness. Or they may be older and from a generation where mental illness comes with more stigma than it does now. Be your own cheerleader. At the end of the day, you must be your own greatest support. Although it takes practice, treat yourself with kindness and gentleness. Talk to yourself in a positive tone. If you are negative with yourself, it will only worsen your symptoms. If your mind is going in circles and going over negative things, try to find different ways to change your thoughts and your mentality. Look for different ways to break the pattern, such as reframing your thoughts from, I hate myself, to, I have depression and need to give myself compassion. Don't believe depression misconceptions. Whatever anyone says, depression is not a reflection of laziness or weakness. Depression is a medical illness. No matter what you might think, the concept that you're asking for help purely to, quote, get attention is a myth. Depression is about hanging on until you can start getting better. Remind yourself of these facts, especially when someone is being unsupportive. Understand that other people struggle too. It's possible that a friend or family member cannot support you because they are dealing with their own mental health problem. They may be sympathetic to what you're going through, but aren't able to support you. If someone is too entrenched in their own issues, it doesn't mean they don't care about you. It just means they can't support you because their internal resources are simply all used up trying to care for themselves. Try to be patient or even offer your support to that person if you can. Sometimes the best way to feel better is to help someone else. Look for other sources of support. If you find that your friends and family aren't giving you the support you need, consider looking for others who can. Consider joining a depression support group, either by attending one in person or looking for one online. At first, you might be wary of opening up to a group of strangers, but you may find that those going through a common struggle and experience can be great friends to have. Ask for help explicitly. Don't hesitate to be direct when asking people for help. It might be that your friends and families are willing and wanting to support you, but they just don't realize what you need. They may not even realize how much help you need because they see the strong exterior you show. Most people can't read minds and will be more willing to help you if you give them explicit directions. Cut out negativity. If you have gone through these steps and people are still being negative in your life, knowing what you're going through, you may need to end those relationships. Some people are just mean-spirited or hurtful, and you may have to cut them out of your life for your own mental well-being. If you can't end the relationship, you should find methods to limit contact or cope against their comments. Although this is one of the hardest things to do, don't be afraid to minimize contact with people who are hurtful towards you. Turn negativity into a positive. Sometimes you can use your emotion like anger to your benefit. Instead of channeling these negative emotions, feeling them all internally and beating yourself up for the way the relationship is, use this anger and emotion for something positive. Go get exercise and fresh air, or smash up some ceramic tiles and use the pieces for a mosaic, or even angry clean your house. By doing something physical, you can release your energy and emotions, and it's healthy to have an outlet for your negativity and anger. It's certainly difficult to go through depression. It's even harder when your close ones aren't supportive. However, even if your friends and family don't give you the support you need, you can still give the compassion and support you need for yourself, to yourself. Okay, next up, let's switch gears a little bit. This from Carbon Brief. Food systems responsible for 1/3 of human-caused emissions. Food systems are responsible for 34% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions in 2015, according to new research. According to the study, 71% of food emissions in 2015 came from agriculture and associated land use and land use change activities. The rest stem from retail, transport, consumption, fuel production, waste management, industrial processes, and packaging. The study finds that CO2 accounts for roughly half of food-related emissions, while methane makes up 35%, mainly from livestock production, farming, and waste treatment. Emissions from the retail sector are rising, the study finds. It increased by 3 to 4 times in Europe and the U.S. between 1990 and 2015. The authors also find that food miles contribute less to food emissions than packaging. The authors added that 96% of the emissions from transporting food come from local or regional transport by road and rail rather than international transport. And on a personal note, I would just note when I first started dabbling with vegetarianism, I was actually more interested in kind of, well, world hunger stewardship, and found that high levels of packaging and processing more offensive than the divide between animal and plant. And from an environmental point of view, this seems to be here confirmed by the fact that packaging itself is one of the most unecologically sustainable aspects of our food system, even more so than transporting food long distances. This from Science Daily. Greenhouse gas emissions associated with dietary guidelines vary between countries. Greenhouse gas emissions associated with national dietary guidelines advocating a healthy diet vary greatly between countries, with U.S. guidelines having the largest carbon footprint and India having the smallest, according to a study involving 7 countries published in the Open Access Nutrition Journal. The variations result from differences in recommendations for and consumption of individual foods within the 6 main food groups: protein foods, dairy, grains, fruits, vegetables, and oils or fats. Diego Rose, the corresponding author, said, "Many countries provide recommendations about foods that people should eat for a healthy diet, and previous simulations have shown that if the public were to eat according to their government's recommendations, their diet would be both healthier and have a lower carbon footprint. However, for the U.S., the opposite has been shown. Greenhouse gas emissions were simulated to go up if people followed the dietary guidelines. This anomaly prompted us to investigate how dietary guidelines vary between countries and the consequent implications for greenhouse gas emissions." Brittany Kovacs, one of the authors, said, "These findings hold insights for future development of dietary guidelines and highlight the importance of including sustainability considerations, such as reductions in protein, food, and dairy recommendations, and/or the inclusion of more plant-based substitutions for animal-based products. By including more sustainable, yet still health-based considerations into dietary recommendations, it is possible to influence the environmental impacts of the larger food and agriculture sector in various countries and worldwide." Okay, well, and sticking to the food theme, got this book review from Food Politics, the Food Politics blog, "Bittman on Food History" by Mark Bitton. The book is "Animal, Vegetable, Junk: A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal." Bittman has done a thorough synthesis of the key events that transformed our food system from one that was healthy and sustainable, if hard on farmers, to today's unsustainably industrialized system that is mainly set up to feed animals and fuel cars, and to encourage us to consume ultra-processed diets. We pay the externalized costs of the system in overweight and chronic diseases that increases our vulnerability to COVID-19 and environmental degradation and climate change. Here is an excerpt. You will hear the food system is broken, but the truth is that it works almost perfectly for big food. It also works well enough for about a third of the world's people, who have the money to demand and have at a moment's notice virtually any food in the world. But it doesn't work well enough to nourish most of humanity, and it doesn't work well enough to husband our resources so that it can endure. Indeed, the system has created a public health crisis, one whose effects have, in turn, exacerbated the deadly effects of COVID-19. And perhaps even more crucially, it's a chief contributor to the foremost threat to our species, the climate crisis. The way we produce food threatens everyone, even the wealthiest and cleverest. This from Vox. The surprise catch of seafood trawling: massive greenhouse gas emissions. A new study shows that one industrial fishing method emits as much carbon dioxide annually as the aviation industry. Seafood has generally been considered part of a low-carbon diet, but new research points to a surprising link between fishing and carbon emissions. Bottom trawling, a widespread fishing practice, emits as much carbon dioxide as airplanes do annually, a study published in the journal Nature found. Bottom trawling, which entails dragging a weighted net along the ocean floor to catch low-lying seafood such as shrimp, crab, and flounder, is notorious for wreaking havoc on ecosystems. In addition to the species the trawler targets, turtles and other marine life can get caught in the large nets and can die as a result. On top of that, we're learning that trawlers also release significant carbon dioxide emissions into the ocean by disrupting carbon-rich sediments when they rake the seafloor. And meanwhile, on land, a little bit of good news, this from Science Daily. Feeding cattle seaweed reduces their greenhouse gas emissions 82%. Woohoo! A bit of seaweed in cattle food could reduce methane emissions from beef cattle as much as 82%, according to a new finding from researchers at the University of California, Davis. We now have sound evidence that seafood in a cattle diet is effective at reducing greenhouse gases and that efficacy does not diminish over time, said Hermes Cabria, professor and chair of the Department of Animal Science and director of the World Food Center. Over the course of 5 months last summer, the researchers added scant amounts of seaweed to the diet of 21 beef cattle and tracked their weight gain and methane emissions. Cattle that consumed doses of about 3 ounces of seaweed gained as much weight as their herd mates while burping out 82% less methane into the atmosphere. Greenhouse gases are a major cause of climate change, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas. Agriculture is responsible for 10% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and half of those come from cows and other ruminant animals that belch methane and other gases throughout the day as they digest forages like grass and hay. All right, well, go agricultural science. And moving a little more broadly, this from The Guardian. Land could be worth more left to nature than when farmed, study finds. The economic benefits of protecting nature-rich sites such as wetlands and woodlands outweigh the profit which could be made by using the land for resource extraction, according to the largest study yet to look at the value of protecting nature at specific locations. Scientists analyzed 24 sites in 6 continents and found the assets returned of ecosystem services, such as carbon storage and flood prevention, created by conservation work, was, pound for pound, greater than man-made capital created by using the land for activities such as forestry or farming cereals, sugar, tea, or cocoa. The study, which was led by academics at Cambridge University with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, suggests further modifying nature for human use could be costing society more than it benefits it, but these natural capital costs are often not taken into account by decision makers. It echoes the findings of a landmark review released last month by Professor Sir Partha Dasgupta, the Cambridge economist, which warned that the failure of economics to take into account the depletion of the natural world was putting the planet at, quote, extreme risk. More than 70% of these nature-rich sites were found to be worth more in net economic benefits to people if they were left as natural habitats, and all forested sites were worth more with the trees left standing, according to the paper. This suggests that even if people were only interested in money and not nature, conserving these habitats still makes financial sense. The authors insisted that their study should not be used to argue for widespread abandonment of human-dominated landscapes, but said it shows there are lessons to learn about the way we treat natural capital. We dismiss the flow of services that aren't easily captured on markets at our own peril. As much as I'd like the world to work in a different way, people make economic decisions on the basis of information like this. Okay, and more cutting-edge science, this from phys.org, that's P-H-Y-S as in physics.org. Study finds evidence of 55 new chemicals in people. Scientists at UC San Francisco have detected 109 chemicals in a study of pregnant women, including 55 chemicals never before reported in people, and 42, quote, mystery chemicals, whose sources and uses are unknown. The chemicals most likely come from consumer products or other industrial sources. They were found in both the blood of pregnant women as well as their newborn children, suggesting they are traveling through the mother's placenta. These chemicals have probably been in people for quite some time, but our technology is now helping us to identify more of them, said Tracy Woodruff, a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at UC San Francisco. The 109 chemicals researchers found in the blood samples from pregnant women and their newborns are found in many different types of products. For example, 40 are used as plasticizers, 28 in cosmetics, 25 in consumer products, 29 as pharmaceuticals, 23 as pesticides, 3 as flame retardants, and 7 are PFAS compounds, which are used in carpeting, upholstery, and other applications. The research say it's possible there are also other uses for all of these chemicals. It's very concerning that we are unable to identify the uses or sources of so many of these chemicals, Woodruff said. The EPA must do a better job of requiring the chemical industry to standardize its reporting of chemical compounds and uses, and they need to use their authority to ensure that we have adequate information to evaluate potential health harms and remove chemicals from the market that pose a risk. Okay, in news related to the single most preventable cause of death in the U.S., cigarette smoking. This from Medical Express. Starting smoking cessation in hospitalized patients would reduce many premature deaths. Smoking cigarettes causes 480,000 premature deaths each year in the United States, due mainly to a 2-fold risk of cardiovascular disease and a 20-fold risk of lung cancer. Although smoking rates have declined dramatically, there are currently 35 million smokers in the U.S. In a commentary published in the Ochsner Medical Journal, Dr. Charles Hennekins and colleagues highlight how failure to institute smoking cessation in hospitalized patients is a missed opportunity to avoid many premature deaths. Each year in the U.S., approximately 30 million hospitalizations occur in individuals 18 and older. Of these, more than 7 million are current cigarette smokers, whose average hospital stay is several days. The authors comment that starting smoking cessation therapy during hospitalization and maintaining high adherence post-discharge can markedly improve permanent quit rates in these patients with minimal to no side effects. Smoking cessation therapy also should include long-term counseling and at least 90 days of prescription drug, in particular, varenicline, which works by blocking the pleasurable sensations of nicotine on the brain. Providing multifactorial intensive counseling interventions during and after hospitalization and initiating and maintaining adherence to drug therapies are all independent predictors of permanent smoking cessation rates, says Hennekins. All of these efforts have the potential to reduce many premature deaths from cigarette smoking, which remain alarmingly and unnecessarily high in the U.S. and has already become so worldwide. Quitting smoking reduces the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease, beginning with a matter of months, reaching that of a lifelong non-smoker within a few years, even among older adults. In contrast, reductions in mortality risk from lung cancer only begin to appear several years after quitting, and even by 10 years, the risk is reduced to only approximately midway between continuing smokers and lifelong smokers. This is because the risk of cardiovascular disease relates to the numbers of cigarettes currently smoked, and the risk of cancer to the duration of the habit. If you or someone you know would like to quit smoking, you can call the Ohio Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Get lots of resources, counseling, the whole works. So if you or someone you love is smoking would like to quit, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, I want to switch gears here and go big with this study from Science Daily. A new way to measure human well-being towards sustainability. From science to implementation, how do we know if humankind is moving in the right directions towards global sustainability? The ambitious aim of the Sustainable Development Goals is a global call to action to end poverty, protect the planet, and ensure all people enjoy peace and prosperity by 2030. To monitor progress towards these goals, a set of over 220 indicators is used, but there's a danger that one can no longer see the forest for the trees. A single comprehensive indicator to assess the overall progress is needed. In a new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers and colleagues from the University of Vienna and the Bocconi University present an indicator based on life expectancy and benchmarks of objective and subjective well-being, the Years of Good Life Indicator. Many existing indicators of well-being do not consider the basic fact that being alive is a prerequisite for enjoying any quality of life. In addition, they often disregard the length of life. Life expectancy has long been used as a very comprehensive indicator of human development, with avoiding premature death being a universally shared aspiration. However, mere survival is not enough to enjoy life and its qualities, explains lead author Wolfgang Lutz. The Years of Good Life Indicator only counts a year as a good year if individuals are simultaneously not living in absolute poverty, free from cognitive and physical limitations, and report to be generally satisfied with their lives. The results show that years of good life differ substantially between countries. While in most developed countries, 20-year-old women can expect to have more than 50 years of good life left, with a record of 58 years in Sweden, women in the least developed countries can expect less than 15 years, with a record low of 10 years for women in Yemen. While life expectancy is higher for women than for men in every country, female years of good life are lower than those of males in most developing countries. This reveals a significant gender inequality in objective living conditions and subjective life satisfaction in most of these countries. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, Let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-